Welcome to the Idea Pod, a podcast dedicated to exploring and interrogating applied ethics at the University of Leeds.
Hello, and welcome to the Sex Pod, a podcast series exploring the medical, ethical and philosophical issues surrounding sex work, with a special focus on sex work during the COVID-19 pandemic. My name is Georgina James and I will be your host. I'm a final year medical student at the University of Leeds, but I also have a master's degree in biomedical and healthcare ethics from the university's Idea Centre. I'm now back working with the Idea Centre for my medical elective, and this Sex Pod podcast is being produced in collaboration with the department's own Idea Pod podcast. In this series, I will be interviewing people who, for a variety of reasons, have a special interest in sex work. I hope to investigate how the pandemic has affected the sex working population, explore the legal status of sex work, consider potential harms involved in sex work, and ask whether sex work is a job just like any other. So, I invite you to join me on my ethical exploration of the world's oldest profession and enjoy the unique insights provided by my wonderful guests. Today, I'm welcoming Bea Piper onto the podcast, a member of the English Collective of Prostitutes, or the ECP. So, welcome, Bea.
Thanks.
And today we're going to be chatting about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected sex workers and the sex work industry as a whole. So before we sort of get into all of that, Bea, would you mind giving us a bit of background about the English Collective of Prostitutes and what they are and what you stand for?
Yeah, sure. So we're a group that's based on the idea of self-help. And we're made up of current and former sex workers and allies, and that's people working on street and in premises, doing all kinds of work. Mm-hmm. And when we speak from the experiences of our collective, not from personal experiences. So we've been campaigning since 1975 for the decriminalisation of prostitution, for rights and safety, and for resources to enable women to get out of prostitution if and when they so choose. We do so a lot through legal casework, for example, helping sex workers win against charges of soliciting, or brothel keeping or controlling, all of which are laws that are usually used against women who are just working together for safety. We also do, you know, marches, letter writing, campaigns to MPs. We released a video recently as part of our campaign, Make All Women Safe. And essentially what we're fighting for is control over our own lives.
So it's quite an active group.
Yeah, definitely. And also, yeah, just a really great community because we're based in London at the Crossroads Women's Centre. So we have a lot of connections with Support Not Separation, with Legal Action for Women, Women Against Rape. And we also have international sister organisations in the US called US Pros and Empower in Thailand. So it's part of like quite a big activist community.
And just for anyone who's listening who might not be clear, would you mind just clarifying what do we mean by sex work or sex workers when that sort of term sort of used? Because I think it will be one we'll use quite a lot throughout the discussion.
Yeah, sure. So sex work can encompass a huge range of different things, and different people will see different things as sex work. Mm. So for example, you know, full service sex work is what most people think of when they think of sex work, but you also have camming, you have stripping and pole dancing, you have women working as escorts, people working in brothels, a lot of kink work, for example. And also porn. In terms of what we mean when we talk about sex work, we mean everyone, all of those things, everyone who identifies what they're doing as sex work, because I think it's that, you know, broad political umbrella, which is really helpful. Because often as well, once, if politicians start taking away the rights of people in some of those areas, you know, that will be the first sign for other people. So,
of a knock-on effect. Yeah.
Yeah. And that some people are more vulnerable to being criminalized than others. Mm-hmm. So, for example, camming at the moment is in the US under threat from Foster Sester, from people trying to take away the ability to advertise online. But obviously it's much easier than, for example, street sex work, which is much more visible, much more criminalized.
When you're saying camming, do you mean sort of services over a sort of over the internet via a camera web chat sort of thing?
Exactly, yeah. Sorry for not being more detailed. Stuff like OnlyFans, where you can interact with someone,
yes,
via a live webcam or via photos or videos or, you know, yeah, other stuff like that.
Okay, and I think what's really interesting is you said whatever people identify as sex work, and I suppose that self-identification and self-inclusion in that wider community is quite an important thing, isn't it? Being able to include yourself in that support network.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that there's also some sort of discussion or debate around some people who may not call themselves sex workers, but may occasionally do sex work.
Mm.
And some people who might do things, for example, you know, kink work like spanking or being a dominatrix, which doesn't fit into some people's traditional idea of what sex work is. But nonetheless, we share the same political goals. And so yes, it makes sense to work on that together.
Yeah, of course. Something that's sort of come up in my reading and background research is that there is sometimes a bit of resistance from people to see sex work as work in the traditional sense because of a number of arguments. But I was just wondering what your response or the sort of view of the ECP might be to this kind of stance.
I mean, I guess you could go into the sort of theoretical, anthropological or philosophical debates around how home and work and intimacy and, you know, depersonalization have always been very separate, and often as a society we don't like it when those two sort of spheres come together. But I think what's more important is how sex work as work is argued about politically.
Okay.
Like in reality. So very often when people say sex work isn't work, what they're saying is we're uncomfortable with what you're doing. We want you to stop because that would make us feel better and like we have a more feminist world. We don't really care if that means that you can't put food on the table. We just don't want you to argue that you should have workers' rights. That's the crux of the discussion. Yeah. It's just interesting because I think it brings reality into that discussion and says that, look, it doesn't matter if you're not particularly comfortable with what you're doing. Unions don't have to argue that their job is the best job in the world to have labour rights. And that's what we're saying. We're not saying this is, you know, the most amazing job and we're all happy and feminist and stuff. We're saying it's a job like any other. Good days and bad days, good clients and bad clients. But regardless of that, we still need workers' rights.
That's very true. And I suppose a lot of the arguments you see against sex work and the sex industry is that it's exploitative or requires a certain amount of sacrifice. But I suppose what you're saying there is that, well, lots of jobs might require sacrifice and might involve some level of exploitation. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not work. That sort of sum it up.
Yeah, that's great. Very well put. And I guess also if you look at the sort of range of different kinds of sex work and different situations that sex workers in, from people who have very few choices, people have lots of choices, you know, regardless of how they get into sex work, they still need workers' rights. The other argument that people often use against us, which is like, oh, yeah, you don't choose this, you're all exploited, or if you do choose this, then there must be something wrong with you. And all of that is essentially just an argument that is kind of pointless and irrelevant to the fact that, you know, regardless of why people get into sex work, we need support and protections like any other industry.
And you mentioned earlier that the ECP are asking for sort of decriminalisation of sex work. And just for listeners who might not be aware, would you just sort of remind us about the current law surrounding sex work in the UK?
Yeah, sure. So just in terms of laws around sex work generally, the options are full criminalisation, which is what most parts of the US have. Then you have partial criminalisation, which is what the UK has, in that it's legal to exchange sex for money, but everything around that is illegal. So soliciting, co-crawling, brothel owning, any third parties being involved, which in reality just means that sex workers are still criminalised. But the sort of optics is, you know, we don't criminalise sex work, but that's actually not true. So very often brothel keeping is just two women working together for safety, and then they will both be charged with brothel keeping each other, which makes no sense. And the same with controlling. Often you just have two women working together for safety, and if one of them says, okay, I'll work Monday and Wednesday, you work Tuesday and Friday, that counts as controlling, which obviously is terrible because it means that sex workers have less power in relation to their clients and also in relation to the police. And I think a really good analogy is abortion. If you say abortion's legal, but everything around it, the providers, you know, the abortion centres, travelling to get an abortion, if you criminalise all of that, you have just criminalised abortion.
Yeah, if a piece of paper says something different.
And then just in terms of the other types, we have the Nordic model, which is kind of essentially just backdoor criminalisation. It looks more feminist because, you know, it's saying, again, we're not criminalising sex workers, but inevitably what happens is sex workers do get criminalised, especially more visible sex workers, so street sex workers, trans sex workers of colour.
And is the Nordic model where clients or the people who are buying sex are criminalised? Is that?
Exactly. So it's sometimes called the end demand model. But what is fueling the industry much more than the demand for sex is the demand for money. So if you take clients, or if you, you know, make it so that it's harder, you reduce the pool of clients, what you're doing is making it much harder for sex workers to work, meaning that probably only riskier clients are going to be out, and meaning that sex workers have to either charge less for their services or do riskier services to make the same amount of money. So it's terrible. And in fact, some people have said that COVID has kind of been like a dry run to see what a Nordic model would be like, because there are more people in need of money, more sex workers in need of money, and far fewer clients looking for.
So, that's really interesting.
Last one is legalization, which is basically has extra regulation which is unnecessary and makes it much harder for sex workers to jump through hoops, and so still it isn't particularly helpful. And then full decriminalization, which is what happens in New Zealand. Apart from that, that doesn't include migrant sex workers, which is obviously not ideal and not what sex workers were campaigning for.
Okay, so legalization, is that when we set the state says, okay, sex work is legal, but all of these rules need to be applied specifically to sex work? And then that's is that different from decriminalization, just for people who might not be aware who are listening?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's good to go over that distinction, because I think it is often by anti-sex work campaigners, it's sort of blurred. But yeah, legalization doesn't treat sex work like any other job. It makes you register. Often you have to carry around a card. This is the case in Germany. And it's better in some ways, in a lot of ways, than criminalization, but it's still, yeah, it still leaves the door open for a lot of stigma and discrimination. Because, you know, if someone finds out you're a sex worker, which is if you can't keep your anonymity because you have to sign up to a register and give your name and address and stuff, is more likely to happen. Then we've had cases where women often get their kids taken away because they're doing sex work is seen as a reason that they're a bad mother rather than them trying to provide. Or they'll get kicked out of housing, often discrimination in jobs as well. So yeah, legalization is not the same as decriminalization. Decriminalization is sex work, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but it's much better for a number of reasons, including that you have much better access to state support, for example, during a pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. There are a lot of jobs, I suppose, that have different rules to other sorts of jobs. So construction work, as a sort of unrelated example, might have sort of stringent health and safety checks, and people in some sort of caring role, like people who work in hospitals or who work with vulnerable people, might have to undergo sort of thorough background checks before they're allowed to work. And I suppose a point that could be raised would be, in treating sex work like other work, would it be totally unreasonable to have different processes that sex workers might have to go through? And I suppose that wouldn't be included in decriminalisation, would it?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's not that decriminalisation is like absolutely no laws surrounding sex work whatsoever, because we'd still have labour rights, and many of those might include, yeah, stuff that construction workers or health workers would also be bound by. But the difference between legalisation and decriminalisation is that decriminalisation is essentially what we're arguing for, that would put our rights and our needs first. It would be legislation that is made by us as well as for us, whereas at the moment legislation is made totally ignoring us, and often not just ignoring us but sort of actively shouting us down. And so the legalization often leads to stuff like registering, which as a sex worker, which is the way of treating sex work not as work basically, but as a stigmatized thing that sort of needs to be contained and have all of these extra rules. So with decriminalization, I think there would still be some regulations, but they would be ones that sex workers want and need.
And that sort of clarified things a bit in my head. So it sounds like what you're saying is that you're not totally against working laws or legislation, but actually you want, sex workers want to be involved in creating that, rather than having somebody sitting in the government making it without speaking to sex workers and getting some real life experience behind it. Would that be fair?
Yeah, and I guess a good example would be often with brothel keeping, if that's legalized, there'll be a lot of hoops that you have to jump through, and often a lot of money that you'll have to pay in order to register that, which obviously doesn't make it accessible to just a couple of sex workers who want to set up with each other for safety and just want to, you know, run one room just then. When you have it legalized and having to pay more money and jumping through more hoops, what that means is it's only people who potentially aren't sex workers, who have a lot of money, who can then set up and go through all of those regulations, which is just taking agency and power out of sex workers' hands. And, you know, meaning in the end that probably more of our profits go to someone else who can do all of that extra bureaucracy, which is not what we want. You know, we want more power in our hands.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a really good background to sort of base the rest of our discussion off. I was going to ask you, we said that sex work at the moment in the UK is legal, but a lot of the activities around it, such as soliciting and brothel keeping, are illegal. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, going back to sort of looking at the impact of the pandemic, how the government imposed lockdowns and sort of various restrictions due to the COVID-19 pandemic have impacted the legality of this. I suppose when there was a period where two households couldn't even mix indoors, did that make selling sex illegal?
I mean, it certainly increased the amount of criminalisation that sex workers, especially street sex workers, were experiencing, because they're much more visible because there are fewer people there, and so they're more likely to be arrested or have what's called prostitute cautions or public space protection orders given to them, which are incredibly unhelpful and just result in women putting themselves in more vulnerable positions, i.e. going to somewhere that's more isolated so that they won't be seen, or going out at much later hours. So it's certainly increased how dangerous and also how criminalized, and those two always come together.
So I guess if it was the street workers that were particularly affected by that, would you say that the pandemic and the sort of stay at home orders impacted like the type of work that sex workers were able to do?
Yeah, definitely. A lot more women have gone online and done camming, but obviously that's not possible for everyone.
Because it necessitates access to internet, computer, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also having a degree of computer literacy, and also having, you know, a space that you're going to be undisturbed. Like if you're in the house with your family, that's, you don't have that space that you can just use for sex work. Yeah, just also in terms of government legislation around COVID-19, I think there has been a sort of spike in anti-sex worker sentiment in politicians. So it's Diana Johnson's 10-minute bill recently, which is essentially sort of proposing something like a Nordic model, preventing us from being able to advertise online, which just, you know, if you can interact with a client online, then you've got more on them, you've got a bit more power in that situation, a bit more of an understanding of what to expect. And if you take away the ability to advertise online, then you know, you can't do that anymore.
You're going into interactions in the dark a little bit, I suppose.
Exactly. And that was, I think, probably partly brought about by the fact that we saw a lot of really awful media reporting on sex workers during the pandemic, because obviously they're going out to, you know, try and make rent or try and put food on the table. And often the media would, in various newspapers, we saw people's names or people's photos being shared, which is just like horrendous to do. And now that lockdown's easing a bit, it looks like the 10-minute bill is not as much of a threat as we're worried about. But one recent really sad thing that's happened is the Holbeck zone in Leeds.
Yeah.
Has been closed.
The area of Leeds allowed the sale of sex and soliciting within the area without fear of prosecution for sex workers or their clients between the hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m.
And that was by no means perfect, but it meant that women could work there without worrying about getting arrested. And not having that, all it's meant is that women aren't able to work there in safety. And I looked through the report, talking to various people, including residents, both sex workers and non-sex workers, about their feelings. And although from reading newspapers, you would think that all of the community was totally against it, but in fact, what it is just a few very vocal businesses and MPs. And actually the majority, I think it was maybe 60 or 70% of people surveyed said that they thought the Holbeck zone should continue, also called the managed approach or the managed area, with some changes, which I think just speaks so much to the fact that actually often people really do understand that, you know, sex workers work and, you know, sex workers are people just like anyone else, and just moving us somewhere else doesn't solve the problem at all.
Yeah, so I have heard the Holbeck zone criticised. I think it was on by sex workers, actually, on, I think it was on Sarah Pascoe's podcast, Sex Power Money. If I remember correctly, they were saying that the creation of the Holbeck zone didn't really help the problem, but because it meant that sex workers and the client could exchange money in the zone, but couldn't actually perform the service in the zone. So it was meaning that they were driving to the zone to exchange the money but having to go somewhere else to work. I don't know, is that what the legislation was?
I would defer to them on the specifics, because I haven't read loads about it. I wouldn't consider myself an expert. It's definitely imperfect. Okay. And I think the survey said that a majority of sex workers there wanted to have that as an option, but it just wouldn't surprise me at all if it sort of helped in some ways but was incredibly inadequate in others.
In others,
Because it definitely feels like a sort of plaster over a much bigger problem.
Mm.
But I think in some small ways it has helped in terms of knowing that, okay, at least in this zone, I'm not going to get arrested. And
I think what you said about the sort of public's perception of sex workers and stuff is a really interesting and positive thing to sort of take note and maybe should be highlighted more, because I mean 60 to 70% is quite a big majority, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it really, even our public perception has massively changed over the last few years. Like, I've chatted with some other people in the ECP who've been doing this, you know, 40 years and they very clearly remember how the media used to call sex workers vice girls and just be so much more derogatory, whereas now a few people are actually using the term sex workers. And yeah, I think much more often the public understands that, yeah, it's just much less morally judgmental. So it's interesting that often newspapers are sort of, and politicians are sort of lagging behind public perception of sex work. I don't know if that's because it just sells more newspapers, or if they kind of want to be seen on a sort of morally righteous high ground. Not sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? The other thing I was going to ask you about COVID and sex work is, you mentioned it briefly about especially street workers being a bit more at risk, but would you mind just saying a bit more about how the pandemic has affected the safety of sex workers?
Yeah, I guess, so I've already said that it's a bit like a sort of dry run of the Nordic model, but if you imagine knowing, okay, I've got to make a certain amount tonight, and usually I'll have a certain number of regulars who I might see, and I'll probably be able to go home at this time. If you think about now putting that into the situation of a pandemic, you have much more people closer to the breadline and entering sex work for the first time, or re-entering sex work after leaving the industry. You have many more sex workers and far fewer clients, because obviously fewer people are willing to risk being seen and being arrested. So that means that in order to make the same amount of money, you'll probably be staying out for much longer hours in, you know, worse conditions, where otherwise you might have been like, okay, I'll just
call it. Yeah.
Exactly. You'll probably be offering, or a lot of women have needed to offer riskier services or to charge less for their services. So essentially all of that means that sex workers are in a worse position to sort of bargain and to set boundaries.
And I suppose, I think I saw something on the ECP website actually that was saying that in the pandemic, the reports of sex workers to the police of assault or unfair clients or them being put in danger had decreased, but the survey of sex workers hadn't shown any decrease in these assaults actually taking place. So I suppose that just highlights that the pandemic and the lockdown and restrictions introduced a certain level of, or even more, fear and risk, like you've said, which I think is something that shouldn't be ignored.
Exactly. And I mean, even at the best of times, if you as a sex worker decide to report something to police, it's total pot luck whether they'll take it seriously or whether they'll say something like, well, you're a prostitute, what do you expect? That's part of your job, you know? So like, and we have people who've experienced really awful treatment by the police while trying to report violence. And yeah, then during a pandemic, then they know that there's the extra risk of being asked, well, why were you out? It's a pandemic, you know, we're going to arrest you under whatever COVID laws as well. And also, as I mentioned, it's because of austerity and because of lack of government support, there are so many more women and people coming into the sex industry for the first time.
I think that was part of one of the ECP reports that I read, actually. And I suppose that highlights the sort of economic hardship, doesn't it, of people coming into it, but also has the effect of perpetuating the economic hardship of existing sex work, as if the demand isn't as it was, but the supply is going up. That's just by sort of market forces, that's going to drive down the price and make people have to work harder for less.
Yeah, exactly. And then as well, when the only clients who are actually showing up are more risky, because they're ones who are willing to risk, you know, being caught by the police, they're often the clients who normally sex workers would turn down. But they then don't have that option. So just in every single way, the market forces make it much more dangerous and difficult.
I suppose that the other workers who benefited from the government's furlough scheme when work was deemed too risky for them, I mean, admittedly a different risk, which would have been COVID. And I was just going to ask you, what I'm just interested by sex workers' perception of the risk from COVID-19 in terms of actually contracting the virus themselves. And I suppose if you're having to work and having to go out there and interact with people, you are at a greater risk of contracting the virus, especially in the first few waves when we didn't have the vaccine and things like that. So how would you say rates of COVID and things have been affected in the sex work population? And were people, if people did get the virus, were they able to isolate as the government suggested, or out of economic hardship, were they having to work?
I mean, because sex work is essentially, you know, criminalized in lots of ways, we don't have any hard data about any of this. But you're absolutely right, because sex work obviously involves often physical contact, it's a higher risk work to do in a pandemic, and it just puts so many women in just the most awful position of, like, either, you know, you can pay your rent and feed yourself and your kids, but you have to put yourself in harm's way of getting COVID for that. And it's just a horrendous choice for anyone to have to make. And that's the position that sex workers were put in. And that's because of the legal situation, because it's criminalized, it meant that, you know, as a sex worker, you're not on the system often. You can't register as self-employed. Because that would threaten your anonymity, and if you don't have anonymity, then you risk your bank account being closed, getting kicked out of your house. Also, I didn't mention this before, but we think an increase in violent attacks, as well as a lot of cyber attacks, so people being outed online, having their footage stolen, being blackmailed with being outed, and lots and lots of stalking cases. So the fact that our work is criminalised affects all of those areas. It means that we can't access government support, furlough schemes, self-employed, all of that stuff. And when we've, you know, some MPs that we've talked to have been great and said, yeah, this is terrible, we don't think this is acceptable. But plenty of MPs, you know, Conservative MPs, have often, their attitude has been, we've got these schemes, why are you complaining? We don't care if it's not working for you. We've done this thing, and that's it. That's the sort of tone of the replies we've got, is like, we've got this. We've done this. And, like, no further questions.
And so what were the schemes that these sort of MPs were saying that sex workers should try and use?
Well, they talked about universal credit and how you could get quicker access to the first payment of universal credit, and how they'd also upped the amount of universal credit, which is great that they did those things, but it still was often not enough. And often sex workers were already on universal credit and were using sex work to top it up, because universal credit just wasn't enough.
Did sex workers have any access to the sort of self-employment support schemes or anything like that?
Again, there aren't many sex workers who are registered as self-employed, for anonymity reasons. Mm-hmm. And if you look at New Zealand, that had some of the best support for sex workers because it's fully decriminalised there. And so they could just get that instant access to government support. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's just not an option for a lot of people who don't want to register as a sex worker, as a self-employed sex worker in the UK, which is most sex workers.
Yeah. And I suppose the pandemic saw quite a unique situation of the furlough scheme being introduced and people who were told not to work because of risk, really, of COVID, risk to themselves and risk to sort of the wider population, were given, I think, up to 80% of their wage by the government. And I just wondered what your thoughts and the stance of the ECP would have been of the exclusion of sex workers from a scheme like that.
Yeah, it's terrible, because sex workers really needed that, and it seems that a lot of the schemes that the government introduced were not made with the people who needed them most in mind. So yeah, a furlough scheme would have been really useful, but if you don't recognise sex workers' work, then you're not going to be able to give access to...
That's going to be my next question, actually. It's, yeah. It seems to link with this reluctance to view sex workers' work. And I suppose it seems like COVID has sort of highlighted sort of underlying issues that have been present for a long time, but just sort of exacerbated them.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that a lot of sex workers are using sex work to sort of top up the universal credit they receive, put food on the table, pay their rent. So it sounds like a lot of people are in sex work due to economic necessity. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a broad range of people in sex work for different reasons, but definitely, yeah, a lot of people are there to make money. I mean, most of us are, because it's work, and that's why anyone does work.
And do you think that if other jobs that are more traditionally seen as work were better paid or more supported or more accessible, then people would be less likely to become sex workers? Or do you think that it's just on that continuum of another type of work that's an option?
I mean, I think it is just another type of work that's an option, but it's true that basically a lot of the work that is accessible to women is unpaid or underpaid. So, you know, a lot of care work, cleaning work, all of that kind of thing. So we support the call for a care income, and that's because we do so much work that is unpaid or underpaid, and potentially if there were better options, if other work was better paid, then that would be another option instead of sex work. But also it's at the same time stuff like, you know, austerity cuts and cuts to child benefit. All of those things also affect, and like, you know, support services, which have all been cut so much in the last few years, in the last decades, that all of that is pushing in the other direction to make it much harder for sex workers to make ends meet, basically.
I suppose it's that just highlights the importance of not seeing it as, right, well, improving the pay of this job, ignoring sex workers, or improving sex working conditions and ignoring the pay of other jobs. I suppose it's got to be something that takes both sides, hasn't it, to truly make a difference to people's lives, and I guess allow people that autonomy and choice, really, to choose which one that they go into, and accepting that it is people's choice.
Absolutely. We've got a piece of research that we did a while ago called, I think it's called, What's a Nice Girl Like You Doing in a Job Like This? And it compares sex work with other similar work, and, like, you know, the pay, the hours, the how you're treated, and how, yeah, sex work is essentially just another option. And this also makes me think about how often support services, which are not run by sex workers, place a lot of emphasis on exiting and, you know, get plenty of funding from the government, but are much less effective than sex worker-run organisations. So during the pandemic, Swarm did a fantastic mutual aid fund, which then I think we found out that government-funded organisations that are meant to help sex workers were then referring sex workers to, which just, you know, great that they were getting more referrals, but it just feels the wrong way around. Like, if you're getting thousands of pounds from the government, but then you're directing people to a mutual aid fund which has no government funding, something's not right there, you know? But it's just very telling that government is willing to fund organisations where, you know, which aren't political, which aren't arguing for decriminalisation and which aren't run by sex workers themselves.
And I suppose it's just, again, highlighting that people who are affected by the laws and the regulations need to be involved in making them.
Absolutely.
And something that came to mind just when you were talking about the ECPS supporting being paid for care, caring roles that are often unpaid or underpaid, is that I've read quite a bit about the sort of emotional labour and admin and everything that sort of makes up a lot of sex workers' work, but I suppose in the general public eye is maybe unnoticed or underappreciated. And I know that before I started researching and looking into this project, it wasn't something I'd necessarily appreciated. And I suppose it just draws a parallel between the sort of emotional, caring labour that women in general in society are expected to do that isn't paid for. And it's just, I just thought it seemed quite interesting that the parallels that could draw with sex work. I don't know what you think about that.
In her answer, B refers to Revolting Prostitutes, a book written by sex workers Juno Mack and Molly Smith, which discusses the fight for sex workers' rights.
Yeah, in Revolting Prostitutes, it talks about that and all of the parallels with other paid work and other reproductive labour, other labour that women are often expected to do for free, and that, you know, something that maybe is part of the reason why people get so angry about sex work is that they don't like the idea that something that other women often give away for free, that's sex and intimacy and, you know, attention, is something that sex workers have the audacity to charge for. And that makes people feel uncomfortable, which, yeah, obviously that's not always the case. It's not always that simple, but I think there's definitely, yeah, really important parallels to be drawn there. Also with surrogacy in some ways, that has a lot of people similarly being uncomfortable about a woman using her body for something which they see as very, you know, natural, and it should only happen in these specific areas of like love, heterosexual, reproduction, marriage, and, you know, sex workers and surrogate mothers.
That is a point that's quite often argued, that people find uncomfortable with sex work and, like you said, surrogacy. Or I think the other thing is like the idea of organs for sale, like people selling their kidneys and stuff. I sort of thought about that. And there's a philosopher called Anderson who sort of argues that sex workers are unable to maintain sexual autonomy that should come with something as I think he would put sex on a sort of in a different category to other kinds of work. And he argues that if we normalize or decriminalize sex work, it's quite a long step, but could this lead to sex work being seen as like a career option that is spoken about or promoted in schools? Or if people are going into a job centre, would it be another thing that they're offered? Or could it lead to the government saying, oh, actually, you can't have your benefits or universal credit yet because you've not tried to make money through sex work yet? And I think that that's quite an abstract idea, but I just wondered what your thoughts would be on that sort of line of thinking.
I mean, it just very much feels like it's coming from a place of you know, I find this uncomfortable and scary and I'm going to take it to the most worrying place I possibly can, mm-hmm. which, you know, I appreciate that that's what philosophers do. They, you know, think about things that
yeah.
maybe don't exist. But I think that unfortunately what that does is just throw all, so it's like using these potential imaginary women to be worried about, and in the process throwing under the bus all the women who are currently right now needing to do sex work and needing better protections. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, we're not saying that, oh, if you make sex work legal, everything will be fine, capitalism will be over, happily ever after. We're saying that it might not be perfect, but decriminalization would make life a whole lot better for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
I see what you're saying. It's those that seems reasonable to improve the working conditions and life of real people in real time, rather than not prioritizing them on the basis of how it might affect maybe people who might exist in the future.
Mm. Yeah, and also it just reminds me quite a lot of homophobic and transphobic, like think of the children arguments, which it's like,
okay,
you know, a lot of children are currently being brought up by sex workers,
mm.
and they're taught to feel ashamed of that. And wouldn't it be amazing if instead of being taught to feel ashamed, you know, sex work was just seen as another type of work, which, you know, your mum or your parent is doing because they're doing a great job of raising you,
yeah.
and in a really difficult situation. So I think it's so often with these arguments, they're so clearly coming from the point of view of a non-sex worker who is uncomfortable with sex work. Whereas if you imagine these arguments from the point of view of a sex worker or someone who is being provided for by sex work, it just ceases to make sense. It's kind of like, I can't remember which university it was, but it had a stall about sex work to sort of help and inform and support student sex workers.
Quick note to say that B is referring to the inclusion of the Sex Workers Outreach Project, or SWAP, at the Freshers' Fair at the University of Brighton in 2018.
And a lot of newspapers just lost their minds and were really upset about it and saying, oh, it's promoting sex work to students, rather than saying, oh, this is wonderful for all the students who are also sex workers to know that their university supports them.
I see what you're saying there. I think that makes sense. Briefly going back to the sort of impact of COVID on sex workers, I was just going to ask you how you thought the pandemic had affected sex workers' sort of sexual health. Has their access to clinics been reduced or changed? Have they felt less able to go?
I mean, I guess I'm kind of coming at this more from a common sense approach than,
yes,
again, from any hard data, which is like, yeah, when everything's closed down, it is going to be much harder to go to sexual health services and other support services. So, yeah, and I guess there's the additional thing of, because it's criminalized, because it's stigmatized, going to a sexual health clinic or any other support service is always going to be a sort of balance of judgment of like, okay, this support would be useful, but how much am I going to have to disclose? How much is that data maybe going to be passed on to police or social services? Or, you know, if it gets out, how is that going to affect me in other ways?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the very few services that are run by sex workers are obviously much, much better, much more accessible and, yeah, much more trustworthy, but they're just pretty few and far between. So I'd say that, yeah, the pandemic's had a very negative effect. I mean, like everyone in terms of mental health, it's been a very difficult year, mm-hmm. but with everything else that we've talked about on top of that, yeah, the isolation and economic pressure of the pandemic has been massive.
Yeah. So I think from our discussion so far, the main thing I've sort of learnt and taken away is that the pandemic has negatively affected sex workers, but it's not necessarily, it's exacerbated existing problems. It's not necessarily given its own unique problems. It's just sort of highlighted the problems that already exist and made them worse.
Mm.
So I was just wondering if these existing conditions that sex workers are experiencing maybe has made them disproportionately negatively affected compared to the rest of the population. So I think I might know what your answer would be, but I was just wondering what your sort of idea of how this disproportionate way that sex workers have been affected could have been negated or reduced a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do know what I'm going to say, but I just also want to say first that obviously sex workers are affected to different degrees. I did mention this briefly before, but if as a sex worker you're already experiencing poverty or transphobia or racism, then, you know, you're going to be worse affected by all those other things than, you know, someone who's seen as doing kind of acceptable type of sex work. So if you're a dominatrix and you're white and you're wealthy, then you're going to feel these issues much less than someone who might not be doing sex work, but, you know, is still in a difficult situation for lots of other reasons.
Of course,
But for all sex workers, regardless of, you know, how much money we make or anything else, decriminalisation is going to be the thing that makes our situation much better, because it would mean that we could get access to government benefits and, you know, stop sort of institutional discrimination like kids being taken away and housing discrimination and jobs and other stigma. And I think as well, on a sort of broader level, if we can get decriminalisation, then it means it'll be much harder for politicians to ignore us and for media to be really awful, because, you know, we'll be seen as actually workers. In terms of how politicians often see us, the ones of us who are loud and who are organised and who are demanding workers' rights, they say, oh, well, we're not, you know, thinking about you, we're thinking about sex workers who have no choice, who are really exploited, who are really vulnerable. And so by falsely dividing us into these two separate things, because actually both of those are interlinked, it means that they can ignore ones of us who are actually making demands and then create policy that's just aimed at these sort of imaginary sex workers who they thankfully, easily, happily don't have to consult with at all. Yeah, and I think decriminalisation would go some way to making that much harder to do.
Okay. Thank you so much. That was Bea Piper, and thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Centre at the University of Leeds. Find out more at ahc.leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by Josh Armitage.